This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On August 9th, a white Ferguson, Missouri police officer shot and killed an unarmed African-American teenager. Police say the two had struggled prior to the shooting, but some say the teen was killed as he raised his hands to surrender. The shooting has led to much anger and tension in the community. Now the case is in the hands of a grand jury, and a decision could be coming soon. Ferguson's mayor has said he's preparing for the worst, including riots. The story of Ferguson has many parallels to what happened in Cincinnati in 2001 after the police shooting of a black teenager. This afternoon, we'll talk about what's expected in Ferguson and how local leaders in Cincinnati have been taking steps to prevent violence and foster better community relations. My guests this afternoon are Cincinnati Police Chief Jeffrey Blackwell, community activist Iris Rowley, who was involved in the collaborative agreement to improve police community relations, and attorney Al Gerhardt Stein, who was represented the American Civil Liberties Union in the Cincinnati Collaborative Agreement. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon.
Iris, you actually made a trip to Ferguson in the summer, didn't you? Not long after the shooting.
Absolutely. Made three trips this past summer, Pastor Damon Lynch and myself. Yes.
And what did you learn about the situation in Ferguson on these trips?
Well, what we learned is what we knew leaving Cincinnati, going to Ferguson. That the people were feeling as if they had no voice and no answers were being given to them. They were feeling as if they were second-class citizens. The community police relations were at dismal. And it was not just in Ferguson, in the county, where a lot of incidents have taken place, and people had no trust and no energy other than to hit the streets to try to work out its problems.
That's interesting to say that Chief Blackwell is somebody who's looking in from the outside. I have to think that what's happening in Ferguson is something that's been brewing for a long time. And the shooting was just an element that escalated tensions that already existed. When you see something like this happen, is it because there's no trust between the community and the police?
I think so. I think absolutely there's zero trust there. I actually went to Ferguson as well to speak with Gwen Ifill at a PBS town hall forum, and I found what Al and Iris came back saying, that, you know, there was very little trust. There was no collaboration there. There was increased tension. So with all of those factors put together, it's a recipe for a long, tenuous, fracture that needs to be healed.
Al, do you see parallels between Ferguson today and Cincinnati in 2001?
Yeah, and even more seriously, I see parallels between Ferguson today and every other place in America. We are over-incarcerating blacks. We are arresting blacks disproportionately. When you look at all the social science, you see that blacks and whites do not commit crimes at any different rate, but we're taking it out on the black community. They know that, and that's why they're angry. And they have every right to be angry, and civil rights lawyers like me have to find an individual to sue. But it's a systemic problem. So the law is inadequate to solve the problem, and that builds frustration.
I would say, I believe when Jay Hanselman interviewed you back in August, that you said Cincinnati was Ferguson in 2001.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're always one incident away from becoming Cincinnati again in 2001. And so that's why it's so important to continue to do the work that we're doing with the foundation, as Al had laid out about the inadequacies and how you actually really resolve issues of this magnitude. This is a very hard thing to talk about. It's hard to sit down and work it out. And people want to see things happen overnight. We didn't get this way overnight, and it's going to take some time to fix it. So if you have the proper narrative, correct people at the table, work can begin to get done.
As you say, it doesn't happen overnight. In Cincinnati's case, it's still even an ongoing effort.
Still an ongoing effort. When you're talking to people who have for generations felt that their voices were not heard, seeing murders and not being able to work collaboratively with the police, and police not hear them, not utilize any of their solutions and or hear their concerns, it's difficult to change human behavior. Now, we can say to the police department, let's change policies and procedures, and let's sit down and work on guidelines. But when you come from my hood, it's very, very difficult. And what we have here is the beginning of something that we can continue to work on and move forward.
Chief Blackwell, as police chief, in your role, how much emphasis do you place on building trust in the community? That's a crucial element, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I put everything, all my energy into that. That's first. I think that's the first thing. Police chiefs, like Al said, I mean, so many communities are just one event away from being just like Ferguson. We don't want that to be Cincinnati again. So we're engaged with our community. We're collaborative with them, and we involve the community in the type of policing that we do. And like, has been said before, we don't try to over police black neighborhoods. We don't try to over police different type of crimes. We don't do jump out teams and things like that. So we've become a lot smarter and a lot more engaged in the, enforcement platform, if you will. You know, it's problem oriented policing, and a lot of it is organic from the community upwards.
That's critical. The problem basis for the interaction between citizens and police is essential to the collaborative. What we thought and what we're trying to implement is the idea that if the police have a reason that they can explain to the black community, this is why I'm here, man. We've had 15 calls to this address in the last week, and they're all from apartment number 6. And while we're not in crisis mode, while we're not just responding to a service call, we want to talk to you about what's going on, who are the people you're with, how can we help you avoid these crises? That kind of problem-based policing that goes back to the scene of multiple runs, that engages stakeholders from that area, builds trust. Because people say, hey, you're working with me. You're not just trying to take it out on me. That's a big deal. And that's what we're still trying to implement in Cincinnati.
When we talk about problem-solving policing, are we talking about broken windows theory, Al?
Well, it's much different than that. Broken windows doesn't set priorities. That's like we think everything's a crime and everything is a gateway to a serious problem, and therefore everybody's involved in enforcement. Rather, the problem-oriented policing we're talking about is using the data to determine where the problem areas are. Like if there is a certain location that's attracting a high amount of drug dealing, we will get all the neighbors to that location, the owner of that building, the people who use the facility, maybe it's tenants or whatever, all together to say, all right, why are we attracting these people that keep selling drugs here? And you might even be able to involve some of the drug dealers, because maybe they will turn and say, you know what, I'd love to get out of this. You know, help me out. And that kind of team-based engagement with the threat of enforcement, but enforcement directed at the real issue. So if the landlord says, hey, get out of my face, I want to run this bad building, you can say with the nuisance lawyer, fine, then we're going to take you to court and shut the building down. So there's always got to be a carrot and a stick, and problem-based policing provides both.
It sounds like it's building a long-term solution as opposed to just sticking a Band-Aid on the problem.
That's absolutely true.
The other good piece about it is that, you know, the piece that you play, which is really phenomenal, is responsible media and reporting what's actually happening, as opposed to instilling fear in people. When we have a support system of people outside of police and impacted communities, we have the support of media like this radio show, because we've done this before and we've talked this thing through, and it will take many more conversations so that people can fully digest it and get engaged and get involved and help us spread this wonderful, wonderful blueprint that we have here in Cincinnati, Ohio, across the United States.
Iris, you're talking about fear. There has to be a lot of fear in the Ferguson community. And I've seen some dire predictions in some of the local media in Ferguson, with experts predicting riots similar to what happened in 1992 in Los Angeles. Without a doubt, there's going to be frustration and anger in the African-American community if they don't feel justice has been served. But does this really mean that it goes as far as riots?
Well, yeah. When you feel as though your voice is not being heard, and you feel voiceless, and you feel like you have no power, what else to do but take to the streets? And so what we would want to happen in a situation like that, because, you know, believe it or not, Al and Scott Greenwood chased the Black United Front around like, hey, guys, we got something here that can help you all resolve your issues. What we don't realize is that responsible, honest, courageous leadership is not showing up in Ferguson. It's just not. Someone needs to step up and say, hey, let's figure this out. You know, there's a high probability that the officer will not be indicted. Well, that happened here in Cincinnati, but fortunately we had our eyes fixed on, you know, really getting to the root problem. How can we give citizens, how can we give taxpayers, how can we give the city, how can we give the police department a better product, and thus better relationships will soon follow.
You know, I think of what happened in Beaver Creek, Iris. You had the young man who was shot in the Walmart. the officers involved were not indicted, but yet the community kept its cool. Do you see that, despite the tragedy of the whole thing, do you see that there being somewhat of a success in that? Or is that still unfolding at this point?
It's still unfolding. And for me, and I don't know if I'm understanding your question properly, it's like watching Eric Garner be choked to death on the streets of New York, and you watch people walk past and no one says anything. So for me, that's an indicator that Black life really doesn't matter. And so those voices have to, those lone voices in the wilderness have to cry out and say, Black life matters. There are so many blunders. You know, I call out every drop of whenever something's wrong. When I hear the non-responsible media use the word sweeps, and you know, I'll call the chief too and say, "We don't do sweeps in Cincinnati, Ohio." Language is powerful. Sweeps in the Black community means, you know, the police are jumping out, as the chief said, and they're just randomly getting everybody, rounding them up, saying, "Hey, you look like somebody that could have potentially committed a crime." So we don't do that here. We do focused solution, problem-oriented policing. And so when you look at Beaver Creek, you think, the security in Walmart was looking at the video footage, who's communicating with the police? Is it responsible to listen to some random citizen inside a Walmart store giving you a description of what's happening and not talk with security? So those are just some, you know, everyday citizens. I'm not a trained police officer, but I'm sure that there's some protocols that should have been followed.
Chief, what's the effort been like on the part of the department? What have you been doing to get out and talk to people in advance of the decision by the grand jury in Ferguson?
Well, we're here today, and I think this is a first good step for dialogue. And, you know, Iris and I have talked about this over the last couple of weeks, and others in the department, about whether or not we should get in front of it and potentially remind people that there's an issue there, or just remain silent and hope for the best. Like what we had after Beaver Creek. And it was, like you said, it was barely a ripple. But I think this has the potential of being eruptive, not just in St. Louis. And clearly they are preparing for the worst there. I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago with their chief and their colonel of their highway patrol, and they are really gearing up for what they think will be a bad couple of nights or week or so if in fact a no bill does get returned from the grand jury there.
I was on the phone with a civil rights attorney in Ferguson just a couple of days ago, and I agree, Chief. I mean, what they are, they're just hunkering down, mm-hmm. and they feel like they're not in front of it at all. They're just going to react when the wave of angry people hits. That's a really sad place to be, especially after all this time and after all the resources of the Department of Justice and everyone else has tried to offer there. And I think it underscores that we're talking about a deep-seated problem. It's just not something that a shooting like that is a trigger, but you need to be able to respond to those things over time in a way that starts to build trust. Here, you're not going to have a body laying in the street for all that time. Here, mm-mm. you're going to know who the officer was who shot somebody. And you're going to have a press conference with the chief leading it within 24 hours. And that's all part of a deliberate process to say to the community, we're going to be more transparent than you're used to. And we'll tell you what we don't know, but we're going to tell you everything we know. And that's been a big help. And whenever we slip on that, we try to remind the chief and city manager.
And it won't just be an eruption due to a no bill coming down. It will be, if there is one, if it's sooner than later, all those things that Al just laid out to you, allowing young Michael Brown to lie in the street for 4.5 hours, being in Ferguson, getting tear gassed by not just the high the county police, but then the National Guard, all of these mishaps and missteps of things that police enforcement could have done. They could have done things a whole lot differently. It did not have to go down like that. And so to not reach out to Cincinnati, I know I wore the chief out. I know he thinks that he and Al think, you know, I believe that they can work magic. You know, they are very magical in the work that they do. I am so impressed by the work that we did in 2001. I believe we were ahead of our time. could you imagine trying to do this in 2014 in Cincinnati, Ohio? I don't know what that would look like, but the product, the work product that we got, the relationships that have been formed, the way that policing is being done, the feedback that I get, and it's not, we're not 100% there. We still have work to do. But what we do have is much better than what we had in 2001. So I would just hope that someone, and I've even asked the mayor of the city of Cincinnati to reach out to the mayor in Ferguson to help save the people. I think that's our job. That's our duty. Once we've gone through it, they don't need to suffer, like we suffered in Cincinnati, Ohio.
After the break, we'll continue with a look at the collaborative agreement the steps leaders here in Cincinnati are taking to prevent violence. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guests this afternoon are Cincinnati Police Chief Jeffrey Blackwell, community activist Iris Rowley, and attorney Al Gerhard Stein. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And joining us right now is the Reverend Damon Lynch. Good afternoon, Reverend. Thanks for being here.
Mark, thank you. And welcome to all your guests. Hello to all your guests.
Hey, Pastor.
Hey, and I just called to thank all three of them, especially Iris and Al, for their hard work over the years and helping Cincinnati become a better place. And then the chief coming in and joining in. And as Iris said, our focus towards not only Ferguson, but anywhere that there are poor police-community relations, I think we have a model here in Cincinnati that is workable, and that we can export to other communities. So I just want to congratulate all of them on the hard work that they continue to do here in Cincinnati.
Reverend Lynch, there was a lot of work that went into creating the collaborative agreement, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it was something that didn't come easily. There was resistance to this initially, wasn't there?
Yeah, there's always resistance to change, and so we expected that. But we fought through the resistance, and now the resistance is part of the collaborative. It's part of the team. So there will be resistance in Ferguson and New York and Cleveland and New Mexico, San Francisco. You expect resistance. If there's no resistance, then the product you have is probably not a good product.
So let me just say, with respect to Damon, he filled the need that isn't being met in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. He was a community leader that had very high street credibility. He walked with Angela Leisure, Timothy Thomas's mom, through the streets, really worked hard to calm things down, but he had something to offer, which was this vision of the collaborative. So he was very instrumental in turning the frustration of the community towards some productive activity, and it's leaders like that are needed in these communities.
Reverend Lynch, over time, even though there was initial resistance to this, are people starting to realize the value of the collaborative agreement, that it was a good thing for the community, that it's having the effect it was intended to have?
I think you realize the value every time a Ferguson happens, because that, again, turns the spotlight on Cincinnati and what we did. People will tend to forget the value of what you've done after 13 years. Until a Ferguson or what happens in the Los Angeles takes place. Then they say, well, wow, we've got something better here in Cincinnati. That's when they go back and realize the value. So over time, the value gets lost. Over time, people forget how hard the work was until something reminds us. And so right now we're in the reminder period, and that reminder ought to make us become more diligent to press forward. Because the work doesn't stop.
So would you say there's also there's an element of protection for both police and the community because we have this in place?
Yeah, I would say that. And I think the police understand that sometimes greater than the community understands that. There's part of the collaborative that I know Iris is going to be working on shortly, which is the community part of it, that we really have to re-engage the community. Because there's a line in the collaborative that talks about social disorder. And there's a lot of social disorder, and the collaborative also speaks to that. So mm-hmm. I look forward to working with Iris and Al and the chief on the community side. We fought hard to bring the cops in line, but there's another part of it that there still needs to be some work.
Reverend, we've undoubtedly made a lot of progress here in Cincinnati. What things would you like to see Cincinnati accomplish in the future in this area?
In the area of better policing and
yes.
police-community relations?
Yes.
Again, the community more engaged, not just the leaders or the most vocal voices that you have on now, but the grassroots people. This was a grassroots movement. And in 2001 and before, we had a lot of grassroots organizations in Cincinnati that no longer exist. The Black United Front, Concerned Citizens for Justice, Coalition for Just Cincinnati, the Black Fist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how they all got started. I just know they existed. And now, 13 years later, none of them exist. And we pretty much are relying on, you know, the more established organizations, NAACP and others. I think we need to get back to some more grassroots activity, get grassroots people involved in determining what they want their communities to look like. That's our work, I think, for the next few years.
I'll agree. I think that Damon's on to a very important aspect of this, but I'll add one thing, which is going to make everybody uncomfortable. I think we need to offer some compensation to community people that we're constantly leaning on in order to come and help reduce crime and disorder. I mean, you want them to come to all these meetings, you want them to stay engaged, and yet they have childcare, they have low income, they have lots of other issues. I think
right.
we have to create a pool of resources to make that community engagement more feasible. And on the easy side, even though it also involves money, we have to restore CCA to its full complement.
Yep.
Right now, we only have two investigators. We have cases that are very serious that need an investigation, and that the citizens' community, the Citizens' Complaint Authority, is the group that investigates independently of the police department police violence on citizens, and we need that to be a fully staffed and vigorous organization in order to have credibility.
Chief, what's your take on that?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I think that is a very strong component in the overall arsenal that keeps us on the right track. The Citizens Complaint Authority is most communities don't have that. That's a big thing to have, and I think it came out of the collaborative. It's good. It works. It helps with our transparency. It helps with our truth-telling with the community.
I'd like to say thank you to Reverend Lynch. Reverend, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate it.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Pastor.
Al, what made a difference in Cincinnati? I mean, we're always planning things. We're always coming up with these blueprints of various different kinds. Sometimes they come to fruition, but a lot of times they don't. Why did the collaborative agreement turn into a blueprint that actually has accomplished some things for the city?
Because we learned from our history. We had various community organizations, various police accountability groups. I used to carry around a three-ring binder, several of them, of all the Blue Ribbon Commission reports that came out after every police shooting, after every time Lorenzo Collins or somebody else, Farron Crosby, got beat up. And, you know, the typical response was, well, let's get a bunch of people in suits to have a hearing and wait it out, wait the community anger out, and then make some recommendations that we can ignore. And we named that, called it out, and said we aren't going to do it anymore. And the Black United Front, at the end of 2000, actually collected 400 stories, did a great job of really cataloging the abuses. We filed the suit with the notion of the collaborative process all laid out before Timothy Thomas was shot.
Right.
So we were ready. I mean, that was unfortunate, but it was also a catalyst to take us seriously because we knew the community was that angry and we were on top of it.
Chief, does having something like the collaborative agreement in place make it easier for your department to do its job more effectively?
It does. It makes it easier because we know what the blueprint is that we're supposed to follow. And then what we do is we try to take that and even make it better and make it stronger and add to it. I mean, I carry it around because I wasn't here in 01. So I need to always be able to remind myself of the things that Al and Iris just let flow off their tongues daily in conversation. However, my platform of policing, my whole career has been one that fits well within this document. Community engagement, transparency, truth telling, being connected with people, understanding people, being there when there's not a crisis so that they get to know you and they trust you. And the funny thing that happens when you develop trusting relationships is people in the community will allow you to make a mistake and they won't riot and they won't throw bottles and set things on fire because they understand that cops are human. And we do make mistakes.
So they're more willing to give you the benefit of the doubt.
Absolutely. If they know you and they trust you.
You were talking about you're constantly taking steps to make this better. What are some of the things that the department does?
We do a lot. I mean, we have probably the most robust community engagement platform in the country. I mean, we have the GREAT program we put in the schools. We're teaching that to every seventh grader in the city. We have the H3 Cincy program, which stands for Hoops, Heart, Hope. We have the Chief's Chill Crew, Character, Humility, Integrity, Leadership, and Love. We've adopted two entire schools in the inner city here in Cincinnati. We have a program where we feed needy kids, and we call it Get the Groceries. And one of the new programs I'm most proud of, I know I've been rattling things off because I feel very passionate about this. We have a program called Get the Grades, and we have officers that mentor and tutor kids at some of the most problematic elementary schools in Cincinnati. And at one school this year, our first school, Rockdale Elementary, we rose reading scores by 60%. We did, police officers. So I'm very proud of that. And I don't know of another agency in the country that's doing that, that's engaged on that level. I very rarely talk about cops and robbers. I talk about engagement, how we can help people in Cincinnati become better. We talk about fatherhood initiatives. We have a branding campaign called You Matter to Us. So we're engaged in all the ethnographic issues that keep communities paralyzed generationally. And we want to help impact those.
So you're sowing seeds is what you're actually doing.
Absolutely.
You may not see something in the short term, but in the long term.
Right. Someone will call me in my next city and say, hey, things are going great in Cincinnati.
Now, you were in Columbus in 2001.
Right.
When everything was happening down here. Looking down from Columbus, what did you think of what was going on in Cincinnati?
I was amazed. And quite frankly, I know a lot of the officers here. And I got on the phone. I was a commander in Columbus at the time. And I said, what in Jesus' name is going on straight down I-71?
Wow.
Couldn't believe it. Now that I look back hindsightfully, you know, Columbus has some issues as well. They have a heavy-handed style of policing there that probably needs some reform, as do other cities.
Well, it's like Al and Iris were saying, this is a problem across the country.
Right. So I'm just amazed that Cincinnati does the things, we do the things right here on a consistent basis. And every once in a while, Al has to call me and remind me about something or Iris does or Dr. Eck.
I'm sure they do.
You know, we had to make sure that we were really doing a better job of, memorializing our problem solving activities. And I'm very proud that I have a document that's about 500 pages for Al and Iris when we get off the air here today. I knew we were doing the good job that we said we were doing, but now I can prove it because we
back in 2001, the Justice Department was investigating Columbus and investigating Cleveland in addition to Cincinnati. Both those cities fought very hard. The Justice Department gave up. They entered into very weak written agreements with no court enforcement and no monitoring, and nothing changed. And I have more cases today against the police in Cleveland than I've ever had against the police in Cincinnati. And the police in Cleveland in particular are just really out of control. The Justice Department will be coming down with findings, I think, within the next few days, holding that Cleveland abuses people's rights and needs to have a court order and, you know, enforcement. And here they've wasted all these years,
time, yeah.
15 years, just saying no. And abusing their citizens. And Cincinnati at least got the message early.
Hey, Mark, and you know, the other piece to this, and I know that you talk with police and you will talk with Al and talk with Iris, but the third party in this is the city. And they have a responsibility in making sure that the collaborative, the outgrowths of the collaborative, and that the chief is able to enforce a force that uses the collaborative as a tool. So we all are pretty much, we were parties to this, and we're all pretty much responsible to the growth of this. So I would encourage you to speak to administrations, especially now that we have a new one, to make sure that they support this great work product that has been in play for a while now. And we know that it can work and it can get better in time. We need to make sure that all parties understand that and are committed to doing just that.
So it's always an ongoing thing.
Absolutely.
Always an ongoing battle, always a process, isn't it? Always.
Yeah. I mean, I just found out not too long ago that the city has a document destruction policy of only holding on to things for 5 years. And now we're going nuts. Why are you holding, you know, why are you destroying CCA records that, you know, are more than 5 years old? We want to show the trend. We want to show the history. So, I mean, you always come up with something like, oh, geez, how did I miss that? You know, and you just got to stay on it.
And that's the good part about what we've done. You asked a good question early on, and I'm sorry I didn't answer you in this way. What we're able to do is show Ferguson and cities like Ferguson how we can look back and say, don't do it that way. Go ahead, get in it. Get in it and be about it and be committed to some change. And if the more time that you waste, the longer, the more difficult it will be to change. So just go ahead, jump right in. You know, when we talk with citizens in Ferguson, they say, well, tell us how you did it. And, you know, Pastor and I were like, well, it's a lot of work. We had a federal lawsuit. We had people in the streets. We spent many, many nights coming up with the sanctions and a boycott. And although we thought we were successful, you know, people lose their jobs behind calling the sanctions and boycotts. When you ask people not to come to your city, there are collateral damages to that as well. So if we can offer something where you can bypass all that and get to the getting to it, to the real stuff, getting to the grunt work, hammering it out, that's what I, you know, we shared with people in Ferguson.
We'll continue our conversation after the break, and you can join in 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guests this afternoon are Cincinnati Police Chief Jeffrey Blackwell, community activist Iris Rowley, and attorney Al Gerhardt Stein. You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Al, you were talking about Cleveland earlier. There's been some changes, big changes going on in New York City as well.
That's right. There was a major decision after a very long trial in the Floyd case, which was an attack on the city's policy of stop and frisk. They were pretty ruthless in just sweeping into neighborhoods, stopping just about every person of color they encountered. The hit rate on what they found was extremely low. So you have a lot of totally innocent people stopped for no good reason, totally angry, and it became a routine. So the court found against the city on all these issues, and the court entered an order that referenced our collaborative, saying that that's the kind of reform that this judge wanted to see in New York City. It was held up for a while because the police union wanted to block it. But just very recently, in the last week, the court has ruled that the police union cannot stop the implementation of the order. So they have talked to us. A number of us have been to New York. We go with Kathy Harrell and with members of the department. Excuse me. But it's worked out great. I think they're off to a very good start on reform there, and that's very important.
You think that Cincinnati may have been a little bit of inspiration or motivation for something like that?
Well, they say so. I'm glad to hear that. And have you been up to New York?
I have. I've been there twice.
Okay.
With the four-star chief, Chief Banks, trying to help there. But, you know, I think one of the bigger issues, too, I'm not so much as worried as Al is with the big cities. I know he sues the Clevelands and probably Albuquerque and all of those other places. But the real problem in American policing right now is the demographic inversion that's taking place. Mm. And the over the Rhine folks no longer live in over the Rhine because they can't afford to. And the people in Ferguson were once in St. Louis. And so what happens now is those small agencies in the outlying areas of big city of USA are under trained, very, very, very sparsely trained. and their cultural competence levels are often very low. And so people that have generational burdens of oppressive police behavior don't forget what it was like when they lived in the cities and when they move out in those areas and get mistreated even more. I think those are the spark plugs for Ferguson and other incidents that will surely follow Ferguson as we try to get through this problem with police training.
And that was a big problem for Ferguson. I mean, aren't they primarily a police force that consists of white officers policing an African-American community?
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the chief's right. The Corps is training. And I do see a lot of small cities and I see a lot of stupid stuff. I mean, I just finished a case of an officer who was sitting in his car and called, hey boy, called a guy over who's like all irritated and doesn't understand why he's being called over. And he's trying to follow the cop's instructions and the cop ends up shooting him because the cop got freaked out because he didn't think this guy was following him to the letter. And he should have never. Good training says you never do a pedestrian stop by sitting in your car. And you'll notice that in Ferguson, that started with an encounter where the officer was engaging the citizens while he was sitting in his car. Uh-huh. You know, that's just not good policing. And we do run into a lot of just straight up training errors.
Yeah.
Well, it boils down to a lack of trust and a lack of respect. And it's a two-way thing.
Well, you know, police officers are smarter. They have the ability to understand how to manipulate laws and training and, you know, just the five words that we were taught was I was in fear of my life is a statement that can be made and can be a justifiable way of getting out of bad behavior, poor policing, and not utilizing the appropriate training. I think the chief is onto something as we look outward and even inward. The officer who killed Michael Brown came from a town right next to Ferguson, and all around Ferguson are those very small towns with very small police municipalities that have had these very strange relationships with African Americans through the history. Missouri is, just my own humble opinion, pretty strange state. You know, half of the state had enslaved Africans. The other half had free Africans. So, you know, you have a history of oppression there in Missouri. So you mix all this up. And when you get all this power and control, you have on this utility belt with guns and armors and handcuffs and sticks, and you got backup and you have a vehicle. You are more often, in my opinion, to believe that you're right in your behavior. So that is why it's extremely important for citizens of all races to stand up and talk about what's right and be encouraged to help their police department to do right. I believe, you know, in Cincinnati, I had the ability not to just sit on a search committee for Chief Craig, but to sit on lateral positions, interviews as well. And had the people of Ferguson had that opportunity, they could have had the opportunity of interviewing Officer Wilson to say, you know, well, you know, tell us about what you did in your previous police department. How did you like African Americans and how did you interact with them? And when you have that type of opportunity, then you can recognize just a bad cop. We have bad cops, like we have bad teachers, like we have some bad doctors. And those people need to be removed and we need to have measures to hold them accountable. So Ferguson would have had what Cincinnati has. Maybe we could have saved Michael Brown.
Iris, we got an email from Joan. This sounds like something that you probably want to answer. Why hasn't our country evolved and progressed instead of regressing into racial tension? And that's an email from Joan. Do you have an opinion on that?
I do, but I probably shouldn't say it. And Al's looking at me because I'll
Don't
simply
do
let me just say this, Joan. You know, when we have issues that are race-based, race needs to be, should be part of the solution. And a lot of times things are very hard to talk about. Racism, race, issues of inequity, things of that nature are very, very hard to talk about. And so that's why we need honest and courageous people. And that's what Ferguson is missing. Ferguson, you asked earlier, what did Ferguson not have? They didn't have Al. They didn't have a Black United Front. They didn't have a Judge Delight. They didn't have a lot of things that we had in Cincinnati at that particular time. You can call it divine intervention. I don't know. We were just there and ready to do the work. Joan, some conversations people need to have with people. And sometimes conversations that I may want to have, people may be offended and not want to hear out of my mouth. So I always try to get out to engage.
It's good to remember, though, one of the parts of the collaborative was a very extended community conversation.
That's right.
We had study circles. We had our own collaborative organized meetings.
8 stakeholders.
And yeah, and all the stakeholder groups. And we had police officers and their spouses and city administrators and
youth.
All kinds of different groups of citizens all sitting down with enough time to say what's on your mind. And one of the things the white people heard, which I think we can't forget, is that when you ask an African-American person, what is your experience with the police? They'll talk about being beat up in 1967 in Avondale as if it was yesterday. And that's real. And we have to acknowledge it. When you abuse power in such a dramatic way, it sticks with you for life. And you can't just look at somebody who's been through something like that and say, get over it. And I think those conversations probably need to continue.
And Al, you know, it's amazing, Mark, and maybe we'll send you over that grid to show what came out of those 8 stakeholder groups, because it was amazing. Most all groups said the same thing, and they all independently had their time. So safe spaces were created where people can have courageous, honest, capable conversations. And so, Joan, maybe that's what we need to do, and with your help, maybe we can do that across America.
Yeah. Another email question. Chief, how has police officer training changed in light of all this in the past 10 years?
Oh, it's changed. It's changed dramatically. I mean, the stuff that we talk about now in training, we never used to even talk about. And we have now, we have eight-hour classes, 16-hour classes. We have bias-based policing training. And we talk honestly about it. And not only do we talk about it in training, but we talk about it daily. You know, one of the things that I talk about in my staff meeting with my executive team, the captains and the assistant chiefs, we talk about it almost every day. We talk about police optics. We talk about bias-based policing. We talk about the climate politically of the nation now and how we don't want to be the next community to make a mistake. We talk about not wearing black gloves when it's not cold and things like that that are inflammatory to people. And what Al said is so true. And I used to say this as a young officer, as a young supervisor in Columbus, as a sergeant and lieutenant. You know, it's not okay. When you abuse people's rights and when you abuse your authority, it's not okay. And people don't forget that. And what affects us anywhere affects us everywhere. So when something happens in Ferguson, it affects our ability to police the right way here in Cincinnati, because people watch the news. And when they choked Eric Garner in New York City and Abner Louima in New York City and Malice Green in Detroit and Rodney King and all the other instances across this country, they affect the ability of good cops to do their job. And it's just not fair. So those police officers that don't have the wherewithal to do it the right way need to find something else to do. But the other side of that is this. 99% of all police officers in this country do a great job. They love people. They love being a difference maker in their communities, and they do things right. And when you find cops that make a mistake and mess up, you deal with it appropriately.
Chief, a question from Brianna. She wanted to know, how do you address neighborhoods that have known problems, like Clifton Heights, for example?
Well, you find out what the problems are. And sometimes what we think the problems are, not what the community thinks the problems are. And so when we had a series of town hall forums, much like what Al just spoke of in the collaborative agreement, people will tell you what are the issues to them, what's important to them. And it may not be congruent with what you think is important. So the first step is to police the right way, and that is through community problem-oriented policing. You know, police officers have a default mechanism of falling back on big me, little you. And there's no I, there's no me in policing. It should be just a we and an us. And so when you engage people in conversation and you find out what the issues truly are, before you even start an enforcement platform, before you even talk about how you're going to eradicate the root causation of the issue, you talk to people to find out what really is going on. And then you collaborate, and Iris always talks to me about this. You collaborate with them on how you find solutions. You don't just ask for the problem and then say, okay, we got it, and we'll figure out how to fix it. And Al says this all the time. The community has to be more responsive as well. They have to feel empowered and feel like they're part of the team and the problem-solving effort to stand up on their own and help eradicate crime as well.
Well, speaking of collaboration, Cincinnati School Board President Eve Bolton joins us now. Eve, good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good afternoon, and thanks for having this great show and having this important dialogue.
Eva, you've got an important thing going on with the police department. You have some partnerships working with them. The chief was touching on them earlier. Tell us about how the schools and the police are intertwined in these efforts.
Well, we're both as institutions committed to our young people and making sure they make all the right choices that they possibly can, and make some choices that are difficult when they're kind of addressing some of the issues in their peer groups. But yes, the chief and the department particularly have expanded and deepened long-held collaborative efforts, and actually in deepening those, concentrated most particularly on our high schools. They've also been able to go in as role models and tutors and mentors. Indeed, that's been very useful for our young people. And the summer camps that are character building camps have been very useful. I have a personal story about that where I've seen it actually impact on several young people in a very positive way. And the other piece that is sort of funny, but our superintendent has kind of given the police chief a key to our schools, because he's been to so many of them and has given so many great speeches and enlightened kinds of conversations with our young folks. But, you know, we've had SROs for a long time, but now they're more fully coordinated and focused not only on a positive image, but also, I think, making a deep impression on our young people by their own role modeling.
So in your assessment, these are effective at making a long-term difference in the community.
There's no question about it, on an individual basis and also on a composite basis. We've noticed even a difference in some of our high schools regarding discipline issues, and also reporting certain things that are of great concern to the children have been reported to our SROs. Those kinds of deepened relationships. And also, you know, we have, pardon the term, cops that help us not only police, but they also help us coach. They help us mentor, and they help us tutor. And this is such an important thing for our young people to see. And it's not just that somebody's working on them or, you know, checking their behavior, but instead finding a way to build relationships with them that we know impacts on the street.
Eve, thank you for talking to us this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Eve.
Well, thank you for being here and having this great dialogue.
And Iris, is this kind of thing a good way to build mutual respect in the community?
It definitely is. It definitely is. And one of the things that I do appreciate about this chief and the officers is that they will go into the school not just in uniform, but out of uniform as well, so that they can be seen as human beings, as people, part of the community, not just a police officer coming in because it's part of my job or, I'm assigned here. It's what they actually want to do to help attack the third grade reading scores, that third grade reading guarantee that will predict in 4 or 5 years where a child will end up. So you can almost say that if a child doesn't pass this third grade, this is what science is telling us. If a child in third grade doesn't pass this test, the probability that he will commit crime is higher. The probability that they will not enter into high school or graduate from high school, let alone going to secondary education, is very low. And so to have Cincinnati PD go in and to help children understand what they need to know to pass these tests, to build their self-esteem, to build their courage, to help work through any issues. It's not just about tutoring. It's about being a coach. It's about coaching through math. It's about coaching through reading. It's about coaching through life. And so I appreciate them tremendously.
And we've got about 30 seconds to wrap this up. Iris and Al, if you could just give your quick assessments. What's the progress that Cincinnati has made since 2001? Are we on a good track here?
We're definitely on a good track. It could be better. Again, we need to make sure that all parties are committed to the work product and making sure that the product is better.
Yeah, I agree, and I think we have to keep our focus on community problem-oriented policing and use as many officers as we can in that regard so that we really see a major improvement in all these measures, and we get some help for the community that we expect to help us.
And we need to keep this chief.
There you go.
Thank
Chief
you.
Blackwell, Iris, Al, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Cincinnati Police Chief Jeffrey Blackwell, community activist Iris Rowley, who was involved in the collaborative agreement to improve police-community relations, and attorney Al Gerhardstein, who represented the American Civil Liberties Union in the Cincinnati Collaborative Agreement. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's program was Jim Nolan. The technical director was Rick Andres. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU.